Welcome back to Food Toxicology. Well, today's lecture is subtitled A Tale of Two Metals. And what we're going to do today is explore the historical context and present knowledge about the toxicology of two very important heavy metals, lead and arsenic. The title of today's lecture is The Human Health Risk Assessment of Lead and Arsenic. What we hope to see in terms of this context that we'll try to put down here today is the historical perspective of the development of knowledge about the toxicology of these two heavy metals. We'll see where absence of knowledge led to public health concerns and impacts, and in fact, in some cases, that knowledge was available, perhaps not well understood, but we as a society made extremely poor decisions in some cases. Perhaps we can forgive the lack of knowledge, but in retrospect, perhaps we are less forgiving of the decisions that individuals made, perhaps and in terms of the impact of their decisions on exposure to these particular toxicants. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to do is explore the use of lead and its impact on public health. We're not going to do a complete history. What I'll do is on the course website put some links about some historical timelines of various aspects of lead and its use in history. We'll try to understand and review the toxicology of lead in humans, primarily reviewing ATSDR documents and some new data that's come out in the past decade or so in terms of the potential impacts of lead. A lot of that work, that new research, has to do with neurotoxicity, so we're going to try to review the neurotoxicity of lead and its impact on child development, a particularly insidious impact in terms of setting one's an individual up in terms of potential impact. We'll try to survey some of the public health approaches to mitigating lead exposure. Take a look at how we have made decisions in the past couple of decades that have actually had significant impacts in terms of environmental health and public health. We'll then switch over to explore the human exposure to arsenic. And again, we'll try to understand the toxicology of arsenic through review of some ATSDR documents to get a full scope of the sources, pathways, receptors, and controls of arsenic and its impact on humans. We'll try to survey the food and water arsenic regulations out there in terms of minimizing impact in the U.S. and to a degree in the world via regulations such as the World Health Organization. Finally, we'll close up today's lecture with a review of the Bangladesh arsenic crisis. This is a particularly gripping situation where good intentions ran foul, and we'll talk about that in terms of the context of the clinical presentation of arsenicosis from water. Well, in terms of lead and lead poisoning, it's got a significant history. In fact, it was there were observations of lead toxicosis and problems associated with lead even in the ancient literature. In the second century, the Greeks were actually referring to this element as making the mind give way. So working in the silver mines associated with silver production, there was lead exposure, and lead exposure was an ill health omen for the miners that work there. There are some that think lead played a significant role in the fall of the Roman Empire. Lead was used as a common table spice. You may have heard of leaded wine. Lead salts added to bad wine consumed the acetate from vinegar to form lead acetate crystals to make it taste better. And so leaded wine was a way for someone to take wine that had perhaps not been so good or was overaged and make it taste a little bit better. This exposure, continuous exposure, in terms of not only what was in food products, but also the containers, the mugs, the plates, the utensils associated with the Roman Empire, leave many people to think that many of the named individuals in Roman history were actually suffering from lead toxicosis. In terms of our own history here in the United States, we have had two primary vectors of human exposure to lead, and the first is lead paint. Lead paint is a lead carbonate primarily, and it's one of the earliest pigments. It's a white pigment. Had many uses because of its whiteness in terms of being able to be dyed and used as a base. This has been replaced in recent years by the white paint that exists in your home, hopefully, of titanium dioxide. But it's a big concern in old house renovation because typically the paints that you are going to be scraping off, peeling off in old residences, and this doesn't have to be too old, residences that are pre-1980, for example, typically have percent levels of lead in them, and there can be significant airborne dust lead exposure because of this. So old house renovation is a vector of contamination in terms of household dust, renovation, and also from pica, where children typically, because of a calcium imbalance, will become dirt eaters or, in some cases, paint chip eaters on dilapidated old buildings. Again, recognize that the paint doesn't have to be white. Typically, old paints had a base lead carbonate that was often colored. Leaded gasoline is the other major vector of public exposure in the United States. It was invented in 1921 by General Motors. It was one of a couple of compounds being considered as an anti-knock additive in the early generations of internal combustion engines. It was recognized for its toxicity. There was discussion even in the advent of leaded gasoline about the potential human impact. There have been several review articles written, such as The Secret History of Lead, that appeared in The Nation magazine, that reviews some of the politics and the economics of the insertion of leaded gasoline into the U.S. marketplace. But in fact, the banning and the discovery of the concerns about lead and blood lead levels in the U.S. population led us to start replacing leaded gasoline with what we have now at the pump, and you'll see unleaded gasoline. Tetraethyl lead was the anti-knock compound. In the 70s, they started removing that from the market until a complete ban happened in 1986. As the shift happened, and the shift had to happen over time because many people had cars that would only run on leaded gasoline. This is a part of my history. I started driving in 1971. But with the transfer from leaded gasoline to unleaded, we saw, as you can see on this graph, during this phase out, a decrease of leaded gasoline use and also a decrease in the blood lead levels in the U.S. population, significant in terms of going from an average blood lead level, and this is in micrograms per deciliter, the preferred units for blood lead levels, going from around 16 down to below 10 over this period of time. Between about 1975 and 1980. So significant reductions in terms of cause-effect of a change in behavior, a change in product use, and the public health of a population. Current mean blood lead levels in the U.S. population is about 2 to 3 micrograms per deciliter, so this has had a significant impact overall in terms of public health. We can examine a chronology of childhood lead poisoning to give you kind of a frame of reference. I'm not going to go through all of these bullets, but what the idea here is to explore the fact that lead has been with us for quite a long time, but there have been extremely early observations in what I'll call modern toxicology, modern medicine, even starting in the 17th and 18th century. In terms of some of the concerns about lead use, and especially lead use in an intimate human environment, not lead use in an occupational environment in terms of manufacturing. In the 1880s and 1900s, lead and lead paint were actually identified as problem products. There was instances of lead poisoning, and in fact, some countries in 1904, Belgium, France, and Austria actually banned the use of lead paint in interiors of houses. In the early 1920s, following the introduction of ethyl gasoline or ethyl anti-knock compounds in gasoline, the concerns there, because of some poisonings happening in the manufacturing plant, there were some concerns about the public health and the exposure of this. In terms of our regulatory infrastructure in the United States in the 1920s, it is not as well developed to protect the public health, perhaps, as it is today. Following up on that, it wasn't until 1970 that the U.S. Surgeon General actually posted a comment saying that lead and lead in the U.S. population was a potential health problem. There was a widespread screening program that started in 1971 to identify the nature and scope of the lead problem in the U.S. This followed through in terms of some regulatory actions in the post-EPA years of the 1970s in terms of eliminating hazards in the household, eliminating the amount of lead that's allowed into paint. It currently is allowed only as a trace contaminant in the low hundredths of a percent. A big challenge was when scientists started identifying linkages in the 70s between behavior and neurotoxicity and blood lead levels. This led us to start looking at the relationship of blood lead levels as an indicator of exposure, as an indicator of health outcomes, and we started developing Centers for Disease Control action levels in terms of blood lead in children, especially because of its potential neurotoxicity. In 1980, CDC conducted the National Health and Nutrition Survey. What they found is that the prevalence of blood lead levels greater than 10 micrograms per deciliter, which is the current blood lead level standard, was 88%, a significant exceedance of what we now know is at least a moderately safe level of blood lead. In 1986, the final ban in terms of the ability of the marketplace to sell leaded gasoline came about in the United States. I will tell you that leaded gasoline is still available in some other countries, primarily to service older vehicles. In 1991, there was a tremendous threshold change in CDC recommending a universal screening and an action level in terms of child blood lead levels of 10 micrograms per deciliter. In 1994, follow-up surveys in terms of the changeover from leaded gasoline to unleaded gasoline and maintenance of lead paint buildings in terms of restoration. CDC conducted another phase of the National Health and Nutrition Survey, and we found a 21% decrease in the children who had blood lead levels over that 10 micrograms per deciliter. So again, the environmental health consequences to the mitigation efforts were real. This followed up in recent years, in the 2000s, we've had a significant amount of research on very low blood lead levels, such that the conclusion right now is that no occurrence of lead in blood can be considered without a human health impact. In 2003, there was a piece of research published in the New England Journal of Medicine that demonstrated a 7.4 point IQ decline with blood lead values up to 10 micrograms per deciliter. That's a significant loss. Further increases in blood lead levels were almost a 5-point decrease in IQ levels. In 2004, there have been proposals following this and other pieces of neurotoxicity research associated with lead to lower the blood lead level action levels to 2 to 5 micrograms per deciliter And these have been met with challenges in terms of how to actually do the follow-up clinical investigations and mitigations, because the sources in terms of food, airborne dust, lead paint are not as manageable at these extreme low levels. So there's an economic impact, but also the practical challenges. But there is a tremendous amount of scientific debate going on right now about whether or not we need lower action levels for childhood blood lead levels. 1998, this is CDC data in terms of a survey. These are state-specific percentages of children aged less than 6 years and their blood lead levels. What you can see on this diagram, here's our axis of 0 and to 40 micrograms per deciliter, and here's a collection of states. The range here, the mean, is identified with a white triangle. The bar is the range of the county averages in that particular state. You can see that the averages in some states actually exceed 10, and there are significant exceedances on a county-by-county basis, in some cases over 20, 25, and in some cases almost 30 parts per micrograms per deciliter blood lead. This very complex graphic is a classic one that just shows the routes of lead exposure in terms of industrial production, environmental sources, working its way through airborne dust deposition, our water system, and our food system. I don't ask you to necessarily go through this, but just to respect the complexity of all the sources and the pathways in terms of us down here as humans. What we do find in terms of humans, and especially for children, that one of the primary vectors is in dust, and perhaps most importantly, household dust, coming from deteriorating paint, lead-based paints on walls, and also lead that comes from contaminated areas like mining sites. Children that do a tremendous amount of, on a relative basis, hand-to-mouth activity. Remember that toddlers in the pre-walking stages are in with the dust bunnies on the floor, and they are picking up a lot of dust on their hands, and this has been determined to be a primary vector of lead exposure in the human population, in the U.S. human population. Now, reviewing some of the toxicological aspects of lead, we find that in terms of absorption, that lead, the biological fate will depend on a variety of factors. It will depend, as you well know, on the characteristics of the exposed person in terms of their nutritional status, their age, their general health. Children and pregnant women, for example, will absorb up to about 70% of ingested lead. It gets absorbed through calcium pathways. There's a differentiation between the different forms of lead, as we learned in other lectures in this course, in terms of efficiency of absorption. So the chemical form will have an impact on the amount absorbed. In terms of the distribution of lead, we find that it's exchanged primarily in three compartments, among the three compartments of blood, soft tissue, which includes the organ tissues, and then the mineralizing tissues, which are bone and teeth. Bones and teeth, the hard tissues, these mineralized tissues, typically contain the majority of the lead body burden. There have been some studies, for example, we'll talk about where children's primary teeth have been used because they lose them early on in their childhood. These teeth have been used as monitoring samples in terms of their childhood lead exposure. Once in the bloodstream, lead is primarily distributed among those three components, but the bones and teeth of adults contain more than about 95% of the total lead burden in the body. Adults will typically retain about 1% of absorbed lead, and children retain more than adults. We find that infants from birth to about 2 years old have about approximately one-third of the total exposure retained in their body mass. We find that animal studies indicate that the liver, lungs, and kidneys have the greatest lead concentrations for soft tissues immediately after an acute exposure. So in terms of monitoring different pathways and comparative toxicology, we typically will use these organs as tissues of sampling and interest. The routes in terms of comparative toxicology studies include inhalation, oral, dermal, and intravenous routes. You will recall that we've done a quick review of IEUBK, the Integrated Uptake and Biokinetic Model. What we've done in that is try to take all of the pharmacokinetics that we know from animal studies and from human studies in terms of clinical exposures and try to put them together in a model that takes a look at exposures, all of the distributions, and it comes up with a potential blood lead level that allows us to do mitigation efforts. We find that autopsies of exposed workers that have occupational exposure to lead reveals that in terms of the soft tissues, that liver concentrations are greater than kidney, greater than lungs, and greater than brain concentrations. We find in children and adults in the brain, there is a selective accumulation in the hippocampus. This is a part of the brain that gives us dimensionality and visualization. The half-life in soft tissues for lead is about 40 days. For bone, it's significantly longer and long as a person's lifetime in terms of residuals. The body accumulates lead into bones and teeth over the lifetime, and it releases it very slowly. It's ultimately deposited. Our body burden for lead is about 94% in bones and teeth. In children, that's a little bit less at about 73%. We find in terms of excretion that most of the lead that is absorbed is excreted by the kidney in urine or through biliary clearance in fecal elimination. In terms of overt toxicity, we find that lead primarily affects the peripheral and central nervous system, renal function, blood cells, and metabolism of vitamin D and calcium, again, because it can interfere with the calcium cycle. It can also cause hypertension, reproductive toxicity, and developmental effects. In times of stress, and we reviewed one case study earlier this summer of an individual that had a fairly high level of storage in her bones and then had a thyroid condition that allowed for a rapid metabolism, a relatively rapid metabolism of the calcium in her bones and some presentation of lead toxicosis that was related to childhood and exposure to lead years earlier. What we find is that although the blood contains or carries only a small fraction of lead, it serves as the initial receptacle of lead in terms of the sources and pathways, and it allows for a distribution of the lead throughout all of the different tissues or, in fact, for excretion. That half-life of lead in human blood has been estimated to be about 28 days to about 36 days. About 99% of the blood lead level is associated with red blood cells in the erythrocytes, and the remaining 1% resides in blood plasma, probably associated with chelation or proteins, free proteins in the blood. We use blood lead levels as a means to measure lead exposure. We also have bone X-ray or density analysis that we can do in terms of looking at bone storage of lead in a clinical setting. This graphic gives you kind of a logarithmic exposure blood of toxicity endpoints to blood lead concentrations in micrograms per deciliter. At the highest concentrations, 100 micrograms per deciliter, we see coma and seizures in both children and adults. moving down in terms of concentration. We see neurotoxicity. We see birth weight impacts. We see the impact in terms of child development in decreased IQ and growth. We do find, we do know and understand that the lead can cross the placenta at very low concentrations, and this does give the potential for transgenerational impacts. In other words, what the exposure of the mother in will yield in terms of developmental toxicity in the fetus. The mechanisms toxicity in lead have to do with some fundamental biochemical processes. Lead is a mimic of calcium, and so it can impact calcium-dependent related processes. It can then interact with proteins, especially ones that have sulfhydryl amine groups, phosphate or carboxyl groups, just because of the inorganic binding potential of lead salts, lead cations, to these anionic or charged sites. We find that the nervous system is the most sensitive target to lead exposure. We find that fetuses and young children are especially vulnerable, and this is primarily because they are still developing and they're growing at a very rapid rate. There may be no lower threshold in terms of children, and we once thought that 10 micrograms per deciliter was safe in terms of limiting harmful effects. We now know that harmful effects can be observed at below the current CDC action level. Acute exposure in children may lead to encephalopathy, and some of these things in terms of the signs and symptoms associated with this are hyperirritability, ataxia, convulsions, stupor, coma, or death. The blood lead levels associated with this sort of neurotoxicity is on the order of 70 to 80 micrograms per deciliter. There seems to be, in terms of recent research in the 2000s and the late 1990s, that there is a direct cause-effect relationship in terms of blood lead levels and decrease in intelligence quotient, or IQ, as well as performance on other neuropsychologic tests. Some of these neurologic effects that we observe in these studies may have impacts into adulthood. One study, for example, correlated lead exposure with lower classroom standing, greater absenteeism, more reading disabilities, deficits in vocabulary, fine motor skills, retention time, hand-eye coordination, more than 10 years after childhood exposure. These give us significant pause in terms of how we go about monitoring and managing public health exposure, given the history of use of lead paint, the history of leaded gasoline, the environmental exposures, and the exposures potentially through the human food chain in the United States. In this particular work from Canfield in 2003, the conclusion, and I'll quote here, blood lead concentrations even below 10 micrograms per deciliter are inversely associated with children's IQ scores at 3 and 5 years of age, and associated with declines of IQ are greater at concentrations, at these concentrations than at higher concentrations. These findings suggest that more U.S. children may be adversely affected by environmental lead than previously estimated. And so this is relatively recent data. Again, how you insert that into mitigation efforts for the public health is the current challenge. And there it shows you the graph of lifetime average blood lead concentration, micrograms per deciliter. And this is the IQ range at the bottom of the graph, 70, at the top, 130. If you consider as the standard in terms of mental retardation is 70 and below, you can see that above 130, 135 as being gifted individuals, if you're talking about average declines of 7.4 across a population, you have the potential to decrease perhaps the number of gifted students in the population, while at the same time increasing the number of children that would be classified as mentally retarded. As I said, there is an observation and a potential for transgenerational effects of lead. What we have here is some data from 1987 in the New England Journal of Medicine. We have three blood lead level groups, low, medium, and high. This is at different ages of testing in terms of the testing for blood lead, but also for their mental development and for an index score. You can see a significant differentiation between the scoring in the low blood lead group and the high blood lead group, again giving us pause and concern in terms of the neurotoxic effects of lead on children and childhood development. Some of the other effects we find with lead exposure, we find renal effects and irreversible neuropathy as interstitial nephritis. We find hematologic effects. Lead will inhibit several enzymes that lead to the synthesis of heme. We see endocrine effects in terms of interference with a hormonal form of vitamin D. There are cardiovascular effects in the development of hypertension, reproductive effects in terms of potential for sterility and teratogenesis, especially at high concentrations. There are cancer effects in that lead is classified as a probable human carcinogen, especially in occupational exposures. There are other concerns in terms of behavior and the neurotoxic impacts of lead. A study in 2002 in Environmental Health demonstrated essentially a linkage between the lead concentration in primary children's teeth and 20 years later or so, for instance, different behavior challenges like criminal activity, lack of development, developmental progress in school, educational progress, social progress, all of these essentially intertwining that in fact lead exposure in a childhood environment will set this individual up for a particularly challenged life, if you will. These sorts of studies are typically extraordinarily controversial, but it does illustrate the point that lead is a toxicant of great concern, something that we should be monitoring, researching, and examining in terms of minimizing the exposure to lead for the U.S. population. The lead action levels in terms of historical perspective, currently CDC is reviewing proposals to lower the blood lead action level to 5 or 2 micrograms per deciliter. There are significant questions in how to do this in terms of how we do clinical intervention if we find, in fact, a subpopulation is exceeding these very low levels. There's no real clear mitigation because there is ubiquitous lead in the environment. There is a significant amount of public health education associated with lead, and the primary household mitigation is removal of lead paint and management of household dust. Children's blood lead levels currently in the United States about 310,000 children aged 1 to 5 years have blood lead levels greater than the 10 micrograms per deciliter action level. And again, the major source of this exposure is lead paint and lead contaminated dust found in deteriorated buildings. There is a relationship, as you can imagine, in terms of the societal impacts, the type of buildings, type of housing, poverty, all of these have an impact in terms of children's blood lead levels. We have significant amount of regulatory standards in terms of lead exposure in the U.S. population. The public drinking water MCL, maximum contaminant level for lead, is 15 micrograms per liter. FDA does have a food lead level in terms of products intended for use by children, and also FDA has banned the use of lead soldered food cans. FDA does have a guidance level in terms of concentrations in shellfish, 1.5 for crustacea and 1.7 for shellfish. We have banned or severely limited the amount of lead allowed in paint, and it is totally banned as an additive in gasoline. CDC action level is currently 10 micrograms per deciliter in air in terms of OSHA occupational exposure, 0.5 milligrams per cubic meter. There is no EPA reference dose, and this probably is respectful of the fact that lead is ubiquitous in the environment and the food chain. It's in a couple of part per million in normal background soils. It's in a trace contaminant in the food chain just because of its occurrence in nature. There is no ASTDR minimal risk level. California does have a reduced drinking water level of 2 micrograms per liter. In terms of the results from some of the mitigation actions of regulatory agencies in the United States, since it was banned in 1998, significant changes have occurred, as you've seen, in terms of reduction of blood lead levels. U.S. food canners quit using lead in solder in 1991. The 25-year phase-out of lead in gasoline reached its goal in 1995. And in FDA, when they do their total diet studies between 1994 and 96, showed that in the previous decade, daily intakes of lead had dropped 96% in 2 to 5-year-olds and nearly 93% in adults. So significant changes in terms of exposure from regulatory action. So the risk assessment, the development of the new knowledge, and the risk communication, the legislative mandates, and the risk management associated with the risk triad actually had the positive effect we would hope for. We find lead is managed by FDA in terms of ceramic ware and utensils. There are specific guidance levels in terms of the types of containers. Containers that are found on the marketplace with values exceeding these leachable lead levels are subject to enforcement and recall. These levels that are used in containers are actually determined by the type and temperature the food is used. If a container is intended for acidic beverages or repeated use or long-term storage, the levels, the mandated levels, are significantly lower in the leachate tests. Well, next, what we're going to do here in this particular lecture about the human health risk assessment of lead is to and arsenic is to move on to arsenic. Arsenic is a naturally occurring element, just like lead. It's not as significant in terms of its use in industry or in the human food chain. It comes to us from iron ores and magmatic sulfides. We find it in sediments and soils as a result of dissolution or weathering of the parent rock. We find it, for example, in river estuaries in terms of washout from mountains. In terms of the natural occurrence of arsenic in surface water and groundwater, it can be as the arsenic 5 or arsenic 3 oxidation state. What we find in terms of anthropogenic sources in soil and water, we have used arsenic as a pesticide, as lead arsenate, for example, and as wood preservatives. Copper arsenate is one of them. These both have been banned for a considerable amount of time. As well, in terms of anthropogenic activities, such as mining operations, excavations, any sort of soil disturbance where there is naturally occurring minerals that do contain arsenic, this can accelerate the dissolution of and weathering of arsenic from the parent rocks into a mobilized form that is soluble in surface water. In terms of human dietary exposure, we do find that there is some arsenic in the human food system from high arsenic agricultural areas. There are some foods that are naturally high in arsenic. In most seafood, for example, there's significant levels. If you have a shellfish meal, your urine the next day will have significant amounts of arsenic. However, this particular arsenic form is called arsenopentane. It's an organoarsenical. It actually is not metabolized by the body to release its arsenic, and so it's got low toxicity on a relative basis, even though the exposure levels are significant. There is a direct urinary excretion of arsenopentane. We also have exposure via drinking water, although, as we'll discuss, public drinking water systems are managed for their arsenic levels. In terms of regulating arsenic in food in the U.S., FDA has no tolerance levels for arsenic in food except for byproducts of animals that are treated with veterinary drugs. We talked about Roxarsone, an arsenic-based animal drug that is used as an antibiotic in chickens, in poultry, and in swine. FDA has established tolerance levels because of these antibiotics being used in the human food chain. These permissible levels range from a half of a milligram per kilogram in eggs and uncooked edible tissues to 2 milligrams per kilogram in certain swine tissues. There is an FDA guidance for levels of arsenic in crustacea and shellfish, 76 milligrams per kilogram and 86 milligrams per kilogram. Arsenic speciation is an important concept in terms of the risk assessment of arsenic. The inorganic species that we find in drinking water are more prevalent and more toxic. We find that inorganic arsenic forms oxyanions in solution. In the U.S. water, especially groundwaters, we find that there's a breakup of about one-third arsenic-3 and about two-thirds arsenic-5. As you'll notice in terms of the molecular diagrams here, arsenic-3 is neutral. When we have neutral substrates, they typically are a little bit more difficult to remove, and so this has been a real challenge in terms of water treatment when you have arsenic-3. In terms of arsenic speciation, one of the ways we can look at that is with geochemical thermodynamics. Those of you that have had an environmental chemistry course perhaps have seen a Pourbaix diagram. This is just a diagram of the stability fields of the different forms of arsenic, the different species of arsenic available in the environment as a function of pH and also redox potential, how much oxidation. So for instance, surface waters will be highly oxidized, whereas groundwaters will be a little bit more reduced or have negative redox potentials. Typically, in terms of the environmental exposures, it's about in the center of this particular diagram. Circumneutral pHs is what we typically observe in nature, and EHs that range from about minus 100 to plus 200 in terms of redox potential. And so you can see these are the primary species that would be observed in the human environment. In terms of absorption of arsenic, soluble ingested arsenic is well absorbed, about 60 to 90% by the gastrointestinal tract. Most tissues, except for skin, hair, and nails, rapidly clear arsenic. And so sometimes hair samples will be used to look for arsenic residues. After absorption, arsenic initially accumulates in the liver, the spleen, the kidney, and the lungs, and the GI tract. There is some transfer to the bones and the teeth. Arsenic oxyanions actually behave in a very similar fashion to phosphorus oxyanions or phosphate. And so if you follow the phosphorus cycle in terms of the human body, typically where you'll find phosphates, you'll find arsenic oxyanions. In terms of arsenic, it undergoes a biotransformation via methylation to less toxic metabolites. These are methyl arsenic acid and dimethyl arsenic acid. These are biotransformed in the livers. The primary route of these biotransformed, biomethylated arsenic compounds are via the kidney into the urine. Normally, we have less than 50 micrograms per liter in our urine. After eating a seafood meal, the total arsenic level, again, arsenobutane, can exceed 1,000 micrograms per liter. In terms of its mechanistic toxicity, arsenic impairs tissue respiration, as you would imagine, because of its potential interaction with phosphate and ATP. It can bind sulfhydryl groups, and it can disrupt sulfhydryl-containing enzymes in terms of its interaction. It inhibits the pyruvate and succinate oxidation pathways. It inhibits a TCA cycle, and it impairs gluconeogenesis. It reduces oxidative phosphorylation, and it can substitute for phosphorus in many biochemical reactions. This all leads to a potential array of outcomes in terms of chronic and acute exposure. In chronic exposure, what we find is primarily targets of cardiovascular effects. Long-term ingestion of arsenic in drinking water can result in pronounced peripheral vascular changes. There can be vascular insufficiency, loss of blood flow. Blackfoot disease, gangrene of the extremities, associated skin cancers can develop as well. We can have Raynaud's phenomenon, which is a vasospasm of the blood vessels themselves, acrocyanosis, which is decreased O2, a bluing of the hands or feet, a cold feeling. And there can be a fibrous thickening of the small and medium arteries and myocardial hypertrophy. These have been demonstrated in human clinical disease associated with exposure primarily through drinking water in some populations. There are neurologic effects in terms of the development of peripheral neuropathy, various sensory motor nerve affections, numbness in the limbs. The dermal effects of arsenicosis are quite pronounced. There can be pigment changes and hyperkeratosis, the development of thickening of the skin. These benign keratoses may progress to malignancy, depending upon the individual and the exposure. In terms of the skin lesions, we find this hyperpigmentation, hyperkeratosis, and skin cancer as being the manifestation of primary arsenicosis. There is also a bone marrow depression that will lead to anemia and leukopenia in terms of decreased white blood cells and decreased red blood cells. In terms of reproductive effects of arsenic, we find that there's an increased frequency of spontaneous abortions and congenital malformations linked to arsenic exposure. It is considered to be a reproductive toxicant and a teratogen, and it does cross the placental barrier. In terms of carcinogenic effects, this is one of the prime risk motivators in terms of arsenic exposure, especially lifetime chronic exposure. What we find is that it is strongly associated with an increased risk of skin cancer and may cause cancers of the lung, liver, bladder cancer, kidney cancer, and colon cancer. It does affect enzymes involved in DNA replication and repair, and this is considered to be one of the mechanistic aspects of arsenic carcinogenesis. In terms of acute exposure, about 50 to 300 milligrams of inorganic arsenic is fatal to humans. There'll be gastrointestinal injuries and kidney damage. This is not a comfortable poison. This is a very violent poison at these high levels. This is when arsenic, as for instance rat poison, is given as a poison to an individual, whether for cause or by accident. There'll be circulatory collapse and respiratory failures. In terms of other exposures, we find that we have potential for industrial exposure in mining and in agriculture. There are opportunistic exposures just in terms of our diet and the cycling of arsenic in the human food chain. treated wood, wood treated by copper arsenate type compounds, has been phased out and banned. We've also had a history of the use of arsenic in various pigments like copper, copper arsenate, copper arsenate as a green pigment called Paris green. It has a colorful history, if you will, in terms of its presentation of arsenicosis by individuals that used it for wallpaper historically, or for in artists that used it in paints doing their particular work. There have been a history of use of arsenicals in human and animal drugs. It is currently used in, again, poultry and swine production. Arsenic trioxide, for example, is used in the management of human leukemia. In terms of the effects of chronic arsenic exposure, arsenic builds up in the tissues, skin, and the hair. It develops melanosis, keratosis, and unusual pigmentation on the skin. It will progress to lesions and vascular system damage. It'll start developing cancers in the skin, lung, bladder, lymph glands, kidney, prostate, and there is some evidence as well for central nervous system damage associated with arsenicosis. It is common drinking water contaminant in the U.S., Taiwan, Chile, Mexico, Argentina, Bangladesh, and India, and others. There have been episodic incidences of toxicosis associated with drinking water. The World Health Organization has a drinking water standard of 10 micrograms per per liter. Many countries, and especially the less developed countries, have maintain a standard of 50 micrograms per liter. The U.S. had a standard of 50 micrograms per liter prior to 2000, the year 2000, 2001. It changed it via some legislation to the 10 microgram per liter with a mandated compliance as of 2006, although there are circumstances for waivers and extensions that will allow this compliance date to be significantly extended. In terms of our past regulation, arsenic is a Class A known human carcinogen. There's a 1 to 2 in 1,000 risk of cancer that some epidemiologists think it might be a 1 in 100 cancer risk at the current drinking water MCL. Or the previous drinking water MCL of 50 micrograms per liter. Arsenic was listed before 1987 as a water contaminant, but there was no BAT or best available technology to remove it from water, and so there was a challenge in terms of complying with the rule and regulation. Arsenic, the MCL historically was in the U.S. 50 micrograms per liter. The new MCL as of January 22nd, and you recall that's the day before the presidential inauguration. This is one of the last pieces of legislation signed by the Clinton administration. It specified the same level as the World Health Organization. What we find is that although arsenic is a problem, the food exposure of arsenic becomes a more important source below 10 micrograms in water. In this legislation, the best available technologies were named in terms of recommended ways to treat drinking water. Because this was done in the last stages of an administration, the next administration, the Bush administration, canceled this or suspended it in March 2001, pending review, with a little bit of outrage and some concern because the rest of the world had pretty much moved forward with 10 micrograms per deciliter. The Bush administration actually did promulgate the final rule in October 2001. In terms of arsenic in the United States, it presents significantly in the western part of the United States, primarily as a groundwater contaminant. This graphic, the darker areas, the darker browns, are areas with very high or predominantly high arsenic concentrations. So you can see that this is a west and southwest United States concern in terms of drinking water availability. There is less water availability in the Western United States, and so this is a particularly significant economic and development as well as public health concern. The current drinking water standard is 10 micrograms per liter. The reference dose for EPA is 0.3 micrograms per kilogram per day. OSHA does have a workplace air standard of 10 micrograms per cubic meter, and ATSDR, the Agency for Toxic Substances Disease Registry, has a minimal risk level of 0.3 micrograms per kilogram per day. Well, now in terms of finishing up today's lecture, we're going to review a case study. This case study is a public health emergency of arsenic in the Bangladesh environment. This is a significant challenge. It's sometimes in some people's representations considered to be a current public health crisis. The scope, and I'll quote this, is a World Bank statement with more than an estimated 20 million of its 126 million people assumed to be drinking contaminated water, and another 70 million potentially at risk. Bangladesh is facing what has been described as perhaps the largest mass poisoning in history. A researcher, a physicist actually, at Harvard University that has made this his passion in terms of the risk assessment of arsenic in Bangladesh, has the quote that Bangladesh makes the Chernobyl disaster look like a Sunday school picnic. In terms of the history of the Bangladesh problem, again a quote, this is from a UNESCO worker. The story beggars belief. In the 1970s, international agencies headed by the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, began pumping millions of dollars in money into the Bangladesh economy for the development of tube wells to provide clean drinking water. And so this was a good thing. According to the World Health Organization, the direct result has been the biggest outbreak of mass poisoning in history. Up to half of the country's tube wells, now estimated to number 10 million, are poisoned. Tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands will die. And so the scope of this particular intoxication is significant. It's especially significant to think about the long-term prospects in terms of potential cancer development over decades for the exposed population. Well, how did this happen? In the early 1970s, most of Bangladesh's population got their drinking water from surface ponds. These surface ponds had problems in terms of vectors for waterborne disease. As it turned out, using tube wells actually had a very positive effect in terms of waterborne disease, and it brought the infant mortality rate down by half. And so this was a significant public health impact, and in fact the United Nations and the British Geological Survey that spearheaded the development of subsurface wells in Bangladesh did it because of the public health concerns about contaminated surface water. As it turns out, they did an inadequate job of reviewing the water chemistry associated with this particular delta of the waters that flow from the Tibetan Mountains down into the Bay of Bengal. And in fact, this delta deposition zone was in fact high in releasable arsenic compounds in the subsurface. They found that the drinking water wells were contaminated with 50 to 400 micrograms per liter of arsenic. Arsenic was getting into the rice, Bangladesh's staple crop, through various irrigation waters pumped from these contaminated soils. About a decade and a half ago, they started seeing a tremendous amount of human health impact. This photo shows a woman with the traditional or the classic arsenicosis lesions, the blackfoot lesions, the keratoses on her hands and feet. This particular individual has a lesion that has developed into cancer. On this slide, you see those lesions again, the black spots, the keratoses, the lesions that develop on the hands and the feet. One of the classic early symptoms is a development of a hyperpigmentation on the chest and arms. It's been described as like spots of rain on a dusty road in terms of how this hyperpigmentation occurs. Again, a classic early symptom of arsenicosis. It's a little bit hard to see in this image, but if you stare at it long enough, you can see that, in fact, this hyperpigmentation does occur on this his chest and arms. This is an image, a very graphic one, of gangrene caused by arsenicosis and the development of arsenic lesions. In terms of the cultural and social factors of Bangladesh, which is a developing country, this has a significant influence on how this public health crisis is managed. The social consequences are far-reaching and somewhat tragic. There's a high rate of illiteracy, lack of information. There has been a significant history of leprosy in this population, and these individuals are essentially assumed to be diseased and contagious. Women exposed having signs of arsenicosis are considered to be unmarriable, sometimes abandoned by their husbands. Children are kept away from schools and closeted to hide the particular lesions and therefore hide the problem of arsenicosis. There has had to have been a tremendous amount of outreach effort by the public health authorities. Again, this is a developing country without a significant amount of public health resources. There has been a tremendous infusion of international support in terms of developing a public health response, developing new technologies, managing this particular public health crisis. One of these is the identification of contaminated wells and segregation of those waters from uncontaminated waters. There have been individuals that go into the different villages and identify wells that are contaminated by little test kits that have been distributed. Obviously, this is of great concern because the well is a source of economic pride to a local population. To be told that you are drinking poisoned water or your village has poisoned water has social and economic impacts, and so there is a challenge in terms of public health management in this domain. Water quality management in terms of making sure that people don't use contaminated drinking water has been reduced to a very simple approach of coloring the wells green if the water is safe and red if it is tested as unsafe. There have also been some public efforts at household water treatment, appropriate technology, if you will. These technologies have been developed by various international scientists to be implemented on a very local basis in this population. They've typically included absorptive techniques using, for example, iron-coated clays or iron metal, which does sorb some of the arsenic and reduce it to lower levels, typically at or below 50 micrograms per liter. This last image I put on here, this is from a World Bank publication. This is a portrait of Panjira Begum and her daughter. What this does, hopefully for the students in the class, is put a face on the arsenic crisis in Bangladesh. In the first world, we often are advised or read about or study these crises and approach them with perhaps the feigned grief of the sleeping village underneath the volcano. What we try to do here in food toxicology is have great empathy and compassion for those that are impacted by food toxicoses. Well, that gives you a good, strong introduction to our tale of two elements, lead and arsenic. On the course website, what I'll try to do is give you enough resources to get some background information so that you can develop at least a limited degree of expertise and knowledge about these two very important elements in terms of their relationship to human toxicology and some of the public health efforts that we have had in terms of mitigating our exposure. We'll see you next time. Thank you very much.